This is the third and final part of a three-part series on the Suez Crisis. If you've liked the show so far, please go and follow me on Spotify, subscribe to me on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts. Thanks a lot. Regime change war is a phrase that is often thrown around today. It was a new idea in 1956. The definition of regime change war is the transition from one political regime to another, especially through concerted political or military action. The term has been popularized by recent U.S. presidents. One of the main issues the Americans faced with their invasion of Iraq in 2003 was almost universal condemnation. Old ally and NATO member Turkey was one such country. A country sharing a major land border with Iraq refused to allow the Americans access to their country for their invasion of Iraq, causing much stress for the Americans, and the Hood Incident, an incident where the Americans intercepted a group of alleged Turkish assassins, targeting a Kurdish group in Iraq, and interrogated them for a few days. It received little coverage by a staunchly pro-war American media, but a deterioration in relations between one of its strongest anti-communist allies, Turkey, happened. Even to this day, Turkey is consistently ranked one of the most anti-American countries. The British would be the same after the Suez. Losing its closest allies, even some of its colonies, such as Canada, staunchly protested the invasion. On March 20th, at 2:30 a.m. UTC, British time, the United States launched an assault that consisted of Tomahawk missiles and GBU-27 bombs. The target was an assassination attempt on an Iraq military bunker, thought to contain regime officials, including Saddam Hussein himself. The assassination was a partial success, with many high-ranking officials being killed, but with Saddam surviving the ordeal. On October 28th, the Israelis saw an opportunity and they took it. Just days before the invasion was to occur, they intercepted a transmission telling them that many high-ranking Egyptian military personnel, including Abdel Hakim Amer, an Egyptian field marshal, were to be flying from Syria to Egypt. The Israelis launched a covert assassination called Operation Tamagol, where an Israeli Gloster meteor shot down and destroyed an Egyptian Ilyushin. The operation was a partial success. 16 Egyptian officers were killed, but Amer was not present among them. He had changed his plans just before and decided to leave Damascus at a later date. With the success of the operation, the battle would begin. Operation Kadesh. Operation Kadesh was the battle plan created by the Israelis for their invasion of Egypt. Adopted as early as October 1956 and updated just days before the invasion, four Israeli armies would storm the Sinai Peninsula to the Canal Zone. The first army in the north would attack through the Gaza Strip to El Arish, located on the Mediterranean, just beyond the Gaza Strip, with two infantry brigades and one armored brigade. The second army in the central region from Keziot to Al Ishmaeliyah, located in the center of the Suez Canal, would be the spearhead, with two infantry brigades and two armored. The lightly defended Mitla Pass to the Suez would be taken by one paratrooper squadron, and the southern desert region would be taken by one reserve brigade. It was decided the invasion would be launched with a paratroop landing and to hold the armored corps back until October 31st. The conflict began on October 29th, 1956. At about 3 p.m., Israeli Air Force Mustangs launched a series of attacks on Egyptian positions all over the Sinai. Nasser wasn't sure it was an invasion. He believed it was just another raid done by the Israelis, similar to Operation Black Arrow, until he heard jets. The Israelis, using covert British and French jet fighters, went on a bombardment campaign of the Egyptian Air Force and key targets. Nasser, who was at this time hosting the Indonesian ambassador at his home, commented,
"I listened and there was the jet airplanes. And I said to the Indonesian ambassador that these are jet airplanes and the Israelis don't have jet airplanes. These are British. I went over to the roof of the house. I saw the bombardment of the international airport. I went direct to the army headquarters."
Nasser was completely surprised with the British collusion. He had expected the French might assist the Israelis, but if the British joined the attack, it would completely diminish their control of the Middle East.
"I haven't thought at all that Britain would do any, would begin any attack against us, because it was clear that any attack against us would affect the British position all over the Arab countries and would mean the end of the British relations and influence in the Middle East. So we were waiting for Israeli attack. We were thinking about French collusion with Israel. We were keeping completely out of mind the British collusion.
The British had an intricate alliance system with many of the Arabic countries, who saw Egypt as both an ally and an adversary. Jordan, for example, had an alliance with the United Kingdom, and had Jordan been attacked by Israel, the British would have had to intervene on the side of the Jordanians. First Lord of the Admiralty, Helsham, ended up sending a memo to Eden on November 2nd, proposing to use the light cruiser stationed near Israel, HMS Royal, to defend Jordan in case of an invasion by Israel. The request indicates that Helsham did not know of the secret alliance crafted by Eden and Ben-Gurion. The next day, the British and the French offered the ultimatum. On the 30th of October, the ultimatum expired, and as Eden knew, Nasser had ignored it. At 1700 on October 29th, Israeli units parachuted into the eastern approaches of the Mitla Pass, near the canal, a political rather than a tactical or strategic objective. The action provided the pretext for a French and British ultimatum to Israel and Egypt, calling on both sides to cease hostilities and to withdraw from the canal area. For diversionary reasons, the Israeli forces also advanced on southern and central axes. Nasser was confused and shocked by this. Did the Israelis plan on fighting the sand? Sinai is in the easternmost part of Egypt. It is mostly just a barren desert, so there were no real key objectives to be accomplished by conquering the Sinai Peninsula. Most Egyptians live around the Nile Delta region. The Israeli Air Force was still deficient. Its development was one of the lessons learned from that war. Armor had proven its ability and was there to stay. If 1948 was undoubtedly the War of Infantry, the king of the battlefield in the War of 1956 was armor. The defense of Mitla Pass, just west to the southernmost point of the Suez Canal, was much heavier fighting than the Israelis expected. 38 Israelis were killed. It was just a token battle to draw the Anglo-French into the war. This caused some confusion, as the Israelis had been slowed down and were not within 10 miles of the perimeter of the canal that was stipulated by the ultimatum soon offered. Many refer to this as Britain and France's covers being blown about collusion with the Israelis. By midnight, on October 30th, the Southern Reserve Brigade took Ras An-Nag on the border of Israel, without any casualties. Slightly further north, the paratroop brigade began its drop deep into the desert an hour after Kadesh began. This triggered the Sèvres Protocol, giving France and Britain the excuse to invade. In the center zone, including the largest force, Second Army, the real fighting was occurring. While the Israelis attempted to take the town of Al-Qasimah, attempting a pincer maneuver with their tanks to encircle the Egyptians, they collapsed the Egyptians and took the city next. The center group attempted to take the vital infrastructure town of Abu Obeikila. The town was vital to the Sinai Peninsula, as it had a road network that connected almost all of the peninsula together. For 3 days, 3,000 Egyptian defenders held an Alamo-esque defense of Abu Uwakila and fended off the 12,000 Israeli attackers. The northernmost brigade attacked the densely populated Gaza Strip. Heavy fighting ensued. The northernmost squad eventually took Gaza Strip, but the victory was not complete, as the Egyptians were able to retreat. The IDF, Israeli Defense Force, pursued them to the town of El Arish. By the 1st of November, their pursuit was stopped by Egyptian artillery. By November 1st, Nasser's army was completely withdrawing from the Sinai Peninsula to the canal zone. A day before, on Halloween Day, October 31st, RAF, Royal Air Force, finally started bombarding important Egyptian bases and airfields to Ben-Gurion's relief. The British, who were first supposed to launch their bombing, were 12 hours late. Ben-Gurion feared that the Egyptians using their Soviet-backed air force might level Tel Aviv. The agreement at Sèvres stipulated that the British would first destroy the Egyptian air force to prevent this. This sent Ben-Gurion into a rage. He furiously called the British, quote, an old wretched whore, end quote. Ben-Gurion never trusted Anthony Eden. One of the tragedies of this conflict was the Kafr Qassim massacre. Israeli soldiers were stationed along the Israeli-Jordanian border. During the first few hours of the war, Israeli Arab villages along the Jordanian border were placed under curfew. This resulted in the killings of 48 civilians in the Arab village of Kafr Qassim. The border policemen involved were later tried and imprisoned, finding that the execution of civilians was blatantly illegal. This event had major effect on Israeli law relating to the ethics of war, and a more subtle effect on the legal status of Arab citizens of Israel. Operation Musketeer. The British and French name of the operation was Operation Musketeer. Also changed just days before the invasion, the army was originally to land at Alexandria, a cultural and economic capital of Egypt. But the location was switched to Port Said, since a landing at Alexandria would have been met with most of the Egyptian army, and fighting in densely populated areas would have involved tens of thousands of civilian casualties. Eden and Mollet intended to use propaganda to overthrow Nasser, first by bombing infrastructure targets and destroying the air force of Egypt. They would bomb Cairo, where the Voice of the Arabs was located. In Cyprus, the Voice of England was pushing anti-Nasser propaganda, telling the people Nasser had lied to them and he led them into this war. It was Nasser's fault for all of this. Then dropped anti-Nasser leaflets all over the country. The propaganda had little effect. Eden miscalculated the effect of it. As the number of civilian casualties increased, the people of Egypt became more unified and defended their homeland against the invaders. The plan for Operation Musketeer was as follows. Stage 1. Britain and France gain air superiority. Stage 2. Wage a 10-day aeropsychological campaign to have the British rise up and overthrow Nasser by targeting infrastructure. And Stage 3. Anglo-French airborne and naval assault and taking of the canal zone. Nasser spread his forces to defend the Nile Delta and the canal zone because he predicted that is where the Allies would strike. By November 1st, Stage 1 had been completed. The majority of Nasser's air force was destroyed, and aerial supremacy was secured. During the invasion, both Nasser and Eden exerted confidence, but on the inside, they were both troubled greatly. Donald Neff wrote that Eden's often hysterical and overwrought views toward Nasser almost certainly reflected the influence of the amphetamines to which Eden had become addicted to following a series of botched operations in 1953. Together with the related effects of sleep deprivation, Eden slept on average about 5 hours per night in early 1956, according to his wife Anne Clarissa Eden. Eden's mental state was seriously impaired. Nasser, however, showed a stronger character. He refused to go into hiding. He rallied his people after Friday prayer on November 2nd. Nasser's popularity skyrocketed, as did the morale of the Egyptians. Now it was time for Stage 3, the land invasion. First, the British and the French dropped paratroopers to secure the suburbs of Port Said. After 5 days of aerial bombardment, 668 paratroopers landed in Port Said. Eden assured the British people in an address on the Suez,
"All my life, I've been a man of peace, working for peace, striving for peace, negotiating for peace. I've been a League of Nations man and a United Nations man. And I'm still the same man, with the same conviction, the same devotion to peace. I couldn't be other, even if I wished, but I'm utterly convinced that the action we have taken is right."
At the same time as the invasion, Nasser had stayed in Cairo and planned a guerrilla war should the army fail. The Egyptians were hiding arms all over the country in preparation for the eventual British occupation and subsequent guerrilla fighting. Civilians, including women and children, were being armed and told to shoot at any Westerner. Nasser ordered ships to be sunk in order to block the canal. This was meant to irritate the British and the French, as well as cause economic strain in Europe in order to get the world's attention. By this time, the canal shipped 70% of Britain's oil and 66% of Europe's. The slogan had arisen in England, "Law, not war." On November 4th, riots had taken place at Trafalgar Square in London. Anurion Nayibevan delivered an impassioned speech at a labor-organized rally condemning the Tory government's decision to take military action against Egypt during the Suez Crisis. Selwyn Lloyd, Eden's foreign secretary and the original British representative at the Sèvres Protocol, described Bevan's speech as, quote, "the greatest ever Commons performance, even though it was at my expense," end quote. The Trafalgar Square rally was attended by 30,000 or more people in the biggest national demonstration since before the Second World War. Eyewitnesses recall chants of, "One, two, three, four, we won't fight Eden's war." Many were discontent with the war, but the rally has been credited with bringing thousands from apathy to active civil disobedience over the invasion. Bevan challenged the government's aggression, accusing the Tories of, quote, "a policy of bankruptcy and despair," end quote, that would, quote, "lead back to chaos, back to anarchy, and back to universal destruction," end quote. After the Trafalgar Square protest, Eden began to feel the pressure. He held a meeting with his advisors to see if they should continue the invasion. They thought the Israelis might accept the UN peace resolution out of fear. The biggest fear for Eden was the secret treaty being brought to light. The day after the Trafalgar Square protests on November 5th, the British and the French sent paratroopers to Egypt to continue with the land invasion. The British landed west of Port Said, and the French, supported by a British contingent, to the east. While the Egyptian military was preoccupied with the Israelis in the east, the Egyptian civilians were fending off the British and the French. One of the first battles was a battle between the Egyptian militia and the British paratroopers, called the Battle of the Cemetery. Many paratroopers massacred militia and didn't take prisoners. They had no option, being paratroopers, they were unable to take hostages. The British Army claims this is not true. On the same day, UNEF, United Nations Emergency Force, was created in order to provide a neutral peacekeeping force in order to replace the occupying forces. Danish, Norwegian, and Colombian troops would replace the Anglo-French. The British and the French were not ready to accept this. By the 6th of November, the paratroopers had freed the beaches of Port Said of the Egyptian soldiers. In the early morning, the British commandos landed and used blitzkrieg tactics while being supported and reinforced for the first time in history by helicopters. The Allies had won a stunning victory in their militaristic goals. However, their political goals had been vanquished. In a coincidental twist of fate, at the same time the first major threat to Soviet control since the Nazi Wehrmacht had left Eastern Europe was happening, the Hungarian Revolution of 1956. The Hungarian uprising was originally a student protest for the democratization of Hungary. Originally, Nikita Khrushchev, the liberal Soviet leader, most famous for de-Stalinization, was willing to give in to some of the demands of the students. Khrushchev believed the USA was supporting the invasion of Egypt in order to take advantage of the weakened Soviet Union. Soviet prestige was crumbling, and Nikita Khrushchev was furious about how he had perceived he was being treated. Khrushchev changed his mind and used the city of Budapest to send a bloody message to the West. His message was that the Soviet Union was as powerful as ever. On the same day as the Anglo-French land invasion, the Soviet premier, Nikolai Bulganin, issued threats of nuclear retaliation towards London, Paris, and Israel. NORAD received a number of reports at this time, including unidentified aircraft over Baghdad Pact and NATO member Turkey, Soviet MiG fighters over Syria, a downed British Canberra medium bomber, and unexpected Soviet maneuvers in the Black Sea through the Dardanelles that appeared to be a Soviet offensive. The Soviets' threats had worked. All of the reports turned out to be false or exaggerated in another epic coincidence. The unidentified aircraft over Turkey turned out to be a wedge of swans. The Soviet MiG was carrying the Syrian president, who had been in a meeting in Moscow. The British bomber had been brought down due to mechanical issues, and the Soviet fleet in the Black Sea, they were scheduled exercises. In reality, the Soviet ICBMs were mostly used as propaganda and would not have been able to stand up to the superior arsenal of the West. Equally shocking to the Allies was the reaction of the United States. Eisenhower feared losing the oil of the Middle East and the Arab world to the Soviets over the invasion. He threatened economic sanctions against Israel if it failed to withdraw from the Sinai. He also threatened Britain's oil supply. Saudi Arabia ended up embargoing Britain and France. Eisenhower threatened to sell off British pound sterling bonds, which would have devastated the British economy. Eden choked, and after 9 days of war, he reluctantly called a ceasefire. It was a major blow to him, as the British were about 1 day from taking the canal, which would have been great leverage for negotiations. Eden said, quote, "If the United Nations will take over this police action, we shall welcome it. Indeed, we propose that case to them," end quote. Still keeping up the charade. A UN resolution spurred by the United States called for a ceasefire and withdrawal of foreign forces. On November 7th, in the early morning, a ceasefire was proclaimed. The Anglo-French troops stopped in the north of the canal zone. They still had to deal with small arms fire from the Egyptians, who were much less disciplined. Graffiti of "Go to Hell" and insults directed at Eden and the Queen could be seen all over the ruins of Egyptian cities. "Our papers aren't able to insult their queen and prime minister?" "Of course we can. Remember the insults written on the wall in Port Said. Remember those words. Should we let them know what you wrote on those walls? You said your queen was what?" They referred to the queen as a bitch. The British tried to downplay the number of dead, claiming about 100 Egyptians had died. In reality, about 650 Egyptians were killed, with 2,000 wounded, one-fourth of them being civilians, many of whom were women and children. For the Anglo-French forces, about 26 dead and 129 were wounded. Eden refused to apologize. On the 17th, he gave a speech claiming, "We are not sorry." The Americans insisted on a complete withdrawal of British and French troops, sending a final blow and humiliation to the Allies. They would have been in a better position if they had troops in the area for negotiations. And if they had taken the canal, it would have been much, much stronger. The Suez Crisis ruined Anthony Eden's reputation. He had been one of the greatest statesmen of his generation before this. Right after Suez, Eden left Britain for Jamaica. His health was failing, and he was advised to leave for a while. 5 weeks later, he returned to Britain and then resigned. The 20th of December was the last time he appeared in the House of Commons. When he was asked if he had prior knowledge of the invasion, Eden claimed innocence. On the 23rd of December, the last Anglo-French troops leave. Britain faced a winter fuel crisis due to the closure of the canal. And on the 8th of January, Eden, with his health failing, addressed the cabinet for the last time. Anthony Eden, to his grave, claimed there had been no collusion with Israel. Just a few weeks after the Suez Crisis, Eisenhower believed Britain and France could no longer be trusted and decided to take over the power vacuum left in the Middle East. He announced Eisenhower Doctrine, stating, quote, "We will safeguard any country threatened by communism," end quote, and deeply getting invested into the oil-rich Middle East. It is still in effect to this day. Mollé fared better than Eden. He survived the political turmoil of the Suez Crisis, but him and his government would be brought down by Nasser's supported Algerian War 7 months later. Franco-American relations never recovered from the Suez Crisis. The Suez demonstrated that France could not rely on its allies. The British, during the Suez, had initiated a ceasefire without even consulting the French, and eventually 2 years later, the Fourth Republic would collapse. Charles de Gaulle, the French Nasser or Ben-Gurion, would return from retirement to create the French Fifth Republic. 10 years after this failed Suez invasion, de Gaulle would withdraw from NATO, dealing a gigantic blow to the anti-Soviet alliance. Many French, like the British, felt disillusioned with their government. The winners of the war were once again the Israelis and the Egyptians. Israel, by November 5th, had accomplished their goal, which was the liberation of the Gulf of Aqaba and the opening of the Straits of Tehran, at a cost of 231 soldiers killed. Israeli confidence in itself and in its army skyrocketed, with Ben-Gurion later writing in his diary, quote, "If they had only appointed a commander of ours over this force, Nasser would have been destroyed in 2 days," end quote. The Straits of Tehran, which had been closed by Egypt since 1950, was reopened. Israeli shipping was free to move through the straits to and from Africa and Asia. The Israelis also secured the presence as UN peacekeepers in the Sinai. Israel stubbornly refused to withdraw without guarantees, even in defiance of the United States and the United Nations. This was to their benefit, as eventually the West gave in to the Israelis. With the Israelis in control of the Sinai, the Fedayeen ceased to exist. Ben-Gurion and his government were heroes. Nasser was also a hero. He had stood up to the imperialist West and won. He was in control of the canal. His popularity skyrocketed all over the Arab world. A Stalingrad-like myth appeared all over the Arabic world for the citizens of Port Said. The British historian D.R. Thorpe wrote that the ending to the crisis gave Nasser an inflated view of his own power. In his mind, he had defeated the combined forces of the United Kingdom, France, and Israel, whereas, in fact, the military operation had been defeated by pressure from the United States. This inflated view would lead to his downfall. He reneged on his promises to keep the Straits of Tehran open to Israeli shipping, and the Israelis won another stunning victory in the Six-Day War. Nasser lost control of the Sinai Peninsula, as well as the Suez Canal. Nasser died shortly after of a heart attack, aged 52. The U.S. invasion of Iraq has had so many similarities to the Suez invasion. Militarily, the coalition forces won a stunning victory over the Arab strongmen. However, politically, both countries were defeated. The British were lucky to have escaped after only 9 days of war. The Americans had been in Iraq for 17 years. Great Britain took a blow to its prestige and lost some of its closest allies, such as the French and the Americans. It is said that the British lost confidence in their governments after the Suez crisis, like the Americans after the Iraq invasion. The USA also lost respect around the world. Many renowned leaders, such as Nelson Mandela, have stated that Bush illegally invaded Iraq and that Bush is a war criminal. The millennial generation and the generation following the Suez crisis grew up to be some of the most anti-government generations in modern history. 13 years after the Suez crisis, the United Kingdom elected Margaret Thatcher, and 13 years after the Iraq War, the USA elected Donald Trump, both of whom have been some of the most conservative leaders, as well as controversial figures in their own right. I don't think that it would be far-fetched to speculate that these regime change wars had something to do with those trends. This was a 3-part series on the Suez Crisis. Thank you so much for listening. If you like the show, please go and subscribe to me on Apple iTunes or Spotify, Google Podcast, whatever you use. That way more people can see my show. I just started about a month ago, but I'm really loving doing this. And so the more people that listen to me, the more my name can get out, the more people that'll... You get the idea.